Welcome to all those that have joined us or may be joining us on the rebroadcast of this Weather Training Teleclass Lecture. This is the second of the South Pacific Teleclass Series for 2007. My name is Jane Barnett and I'm speaking to you from Christchurch, New Zealand. Today's Anzac Day here in New Zealand, so an important day in the history of both Australia and New Zealand. But it's also an important day for us in relation to the South Pacific Teleclass Series, as today's lecture features a person who is well known in international infection control circles. Professor Sito is the Chief Infection Control Officer and Chief of Microbiology in the Hong Kong West Cluster Hospital Authority. He's been extensively involved in infection control education throughout China and the Asia-Pacific region, and was the founding president of the Asia-Pacific Society of Infection Control. Professor Sito has extensive publications and has been widely invited to speak in nearly 100 conferences by international societies, including the Communicable Disease Centre in America, the ICNA in the UK, and IFIC, to name just a few. He's also been appointed temporary consultant for the World Health Organization, and we're therefore very honoured to have him agree to speak to us in this Weber Training teleclass for the South Pacific Series. I know you'll enjoy his presentation. Welcome, Professor Sito, and thank you for being our guest speaker today.
Yes, thank you very much. Now, can I start? Well, thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak to all of you. Am I still connected? Hello?
Yes, you're still connected. I was just putting other phones onto mute.
Okay, all right. Now, let us proceed. Well, thank you again. And my topic today is something that I've been working on for many years. So I'm really delighted to be able to address this important topic. It is making infection control really work, managing the human factor. Now, my second slide is just the simple cartoon, which I'm sure you understand. You know, it's very difficult to change people's thinking. And as this cartoon shows, one of the snails says, "I don't care if she's a tape dispenser, I still love her." Now, it's so commonly encountered in a hospital. People may agree with you mentally, but yet their behavior just simply doesn't change. Now, let's review the development of our important field of infection control. Obviously, as you can see in in this third slide, we first have microbiology, which gives us the basis of infection control, whereby we understand how infection begins and how it works. Now, then the field of epidemiology was very, very important to help us to understand the spread and how we can control it. And it's through a thorough understanding of epidemiology that we were able to write sensible policies. And now we are at this stage whereby we have lots of understanding, lots of good policy written. In fact, I think in the infection control world, we are well known for having guidelines, which is basically a policy. And then we begin to discover that, yes, we may have good guidelines, but it's very difficult to implement them. I think the next slide would make it very clear. As Robert Haley, who is famous for the CINIC study, says, most nosocomial infections that are preventable are caused by patient care practices. And so we need to make policies to change these practices. However, in the next slide, this is just a slide that I'm sure many of you have seen before, on compliance to hand hygiene. And as you can see, it can go down to as low as below 10%, even though we in infection control know this to be a very, very important policy that is already proven beyond doubt. Now, so it's not only hand hygiene. In slide number 6, I had done a study before in which we took 17 CDC recommendations. Now, let me repeat, it's 17 recommendations that is category 1 from the CDC guidelines. And we surveyed 720 nurses in Hong Kong and using a scale, regular, often, occasional, and rarely. How often do nurses comply with these recommendations? And close to half give a score of less than 3. So as you can see, as put in the next slide, we often taunt our colleagues. You know, we say infection control is important because the treatment may be successful. but the patient still died of an infection. Now, there's something that turned us back, which is in slide number 8. We know how to prevent the infection, but we just simply cannot implement the policy. Now, Dr. Barry Farr, another well-known hospital epidemiologist, in fact did a review of this and published in ECHI 2000, and he so succinctly stated that as far as infection control policies are concerned, we have met the enemy, and he is us. So we may have very good policy, and yet somehow we simply cannot implement it. So in slide 10, I summarize again, we have microbiology, epidemiology, but now, really on the front line, we need to learn how to implement policy, and this is where we should borrow from what we call the behavioral science. All right? Now, but why reinvent the wheel? Why don't we just learn from the behavioral sciences? So, for the next 15 minutes or 20 minutes or so, let me just share with you some of these, some fields of behavioral science where we can borrow from. All right? Just a few examples. There are many. In fact, I will encourage all of you to read up all the various aspects of behavioral science and see where we can learn from them and implement it in our field of infection control. Now, the first one is social psychology. And for those of you who have studied psychology, you know this is quite different from clinical psychology. And in slide 12, I define it as the scientific study of how people think about, influence, and relate to one another. In fact, social psychology is a study of psychology as it sort of manifests itself in a society. So it's social psychology. Now, a very well-known social psychology theory is given in slide 13. In fact, in Social Psychology 101, you would come across this theory of reasoned behavior, as proposed by two famous social psychologists, Fishbein and Agin, in 1975. Now, I've drawn a diagram of this whole theory, but really the most important is the square at the end that says behavior followed by intention. Now, the reason for this theory is, or the background behind this theory is this. We used to think that attitude is a good prediction of behavior. If you have a positive attitude, then you will behave certain ways. But it was discovered that this is not necessarily so. In fact, there's a mixture of factors that influence a person, not only attitude. And in this diagram, you will notice that in the bottom half of the diagram, there is this word called subjective norm. Now, subjective norm simply is the beliefs and preferences that is sort of pervading in the community. And all these interact together such that you finally have the behavior intent. And according to this theory, the behavior intent is the best predictor of behavior. All right, so let me repeat. This theory simply states that if you want to predict behavior, what you need to do is to find out the behavioral intent and not just the attitude or other factors. Now, so I applied this study in Hong Kong many years ago, in fact, 1988, and I published it in 89. It was a very simple study. We were starting the needle stick or sharps policy. And in those days, recapping was a common practice. So before we started this study, we just surveyed 208 nurses and asked them if they would agree with the policy of no recapping. Now, as you can see in the table in slide number 14, based on this survey, we are able to divide all the nurses in our hospital in this study into those who agree with the policy, that is the policy of no recapping, and those who don't agree. So let me repeat, now we are able to divide the nurses into two big groups, those who agree with the recapping and those who don't agree with the recapping. Now, can I submit to you that really, whether they agree or don't agree is really the behavioral intent. In other words, if they agree, what they are saying is they intend to follow our policy, and those who don't agree don't intend to follow our policy. Now, based on this classification of the nurses, we then implement the policy of no recapping using three simple standard methods. A, as you can see, is just simple announcement of the policy through the hierarchy. B are passive methods. And in passive methods, we simply use posters and pamphlets. All right, we produce colorful pamphlets and posters and distribute it to everybody. Now, C is we have both the passive method, and everyone in group C will listen to a very, very well-planned talk. In fact, I was the one who gave the talk to all those in group C. So group C is both the active and the passive method. Now, the active method, I usually call it the face-to-face method, whereby I speak to people face-to-face and convince them and explain to them the policy. All right, let's look at the results. As you can see, the first column of the results are all the nurses. The second column are the agreeables, and the third column are the non-agreeables. Now, let's look at A. If you look at A, you'll find that basically, the agreeable is 30% response, and the non-agreeable is 15%. Now, when we did the statistics, in fact, the 30% and the 15%, there's no difference. So, in other words, for simple announcement, whether they agree or don't agree, the outcome is the same. Now, we come to the passive method. Let me remind you, the passive method are just posters and pamphlets. And as you can see, for the passive method, those who agree was 85% change. But for those who don't agree, it was simply 21%. Now, so what does this mean? It simply means that the set passive method, the posters and the pamphlets, works only on those who agree or on those who already has the behavioral intent. But for those who don't agree, whereby you have to change their mind, the passive method really doesn't work. Now, finally, the active and the passive method, whereby there is active face-to-face persuasion. As you can see, with the third method, both the agreeables and the non-agreeables, they both have very, very good response. Now, so in fact, from this study, I was able to conclude that if you want to change the healthcare workers' mind, it is not enough to give them a poster, a pamphlet, or even a booklet. You must talk to them face to face. Now, if their mind are already changed, then yes, the passive method will be effective enough. Now, so in fact, this piece of information was really very helpful for me when SARS hit Hong Kong. Now let's look at SARS again. This is in slide number 15. In Hong Kong, if you look at this slide, as you can see, the number of healthcare workers affected during SARS in Hong Kong was 405. All right. Let's look at the next slide. Slide number 16. Now this just summarizes all the healthcare workers who were infected in Hong Kong. And as you can see in the figure, is 405 healthcare workers, right? But what is important is that blue square on the right. The square there simply states, in my hospital, Queen Mary Hospital, only 2 healthcare workers were infected and no patients. In fact, most hospitals record lots of patients infected, but in my hospital, there are only 2 healthcare workers infected and 0 patients infected. Now, what were the reasons? Of course, the reasons are multiple. In gist, let me just say that I did no special endeavors during SARS in my hospital. It was just good, standard, but effective practice of infection control, basic infection control policy. Now, but let me show you this next slide. Slide number 17. Slide number 17. Now, one thing that we did, and as I understand, we were the only hospital that did this. You see, when SARS came to Hong Kong, they made CD-ROMs, and it was passed to every staff. They have to listen to the CD-ROM and sign their name. Now, of course, I'm not against the CD-ROM, although I would still classify those as passive method. Now, what I did in my hospital was, remembering what the study I mentioned on just now, I decided that I should carry out aggressive face-to-face education to prepare them for SARS. So, you know something? In the first week of SARS in my hospital, I gave 67 lectures. And literally, I mean literally, I spoke to almost everyone in my hospital, every staff. There must only be a few who got away and somehow missed my talks. Because I gave 67 talks in that first week. I talked to everyone I can lay my hands on, face to face. And I believe that that really makes a difference in the compliance. All right, so I hope this is an illustration of taking a theory from social psychology, the theory of reason behavior, taking this theory from Fishbein and Agent, and then learning from it and adapting the principles to make it work and have an impact in our field of infection control. Now, let me give you another example. Another example is to learn from another field of human behavior called organizational behavior. Now, this is a big field. In fact, if you were to attend any management course, they would make you read books on organizational behavior. All right, and it's basically a study on how people behave and act within the organization. Now, there's a very famous theory under this field called participatory decision making. And it's very simple. It's a basic theory on how employees make decisions based on how much they have been consulted. Now, based on participatory decision making, which I will call PDM from now on, there are five types. There are five types of PDM, and this is shown in slide 20. Now, in slide 20, it's clearly shown that there are five types, and they are, number one, no participation. That means the workers are not consulted at all. Number two, just information. That means the workers are consulted just to get straightforward information. Number three is individual opinion. This means they are consulted by the manager, but it's just to assess their own individual views on the matter. Now, group opinion is to get a group together in a discussion and get the group to contribute an opinion, but they do not participate in the decision making. Now, finally, full PDM means you get the consensus. Now, in practice, in effect, you probably even get them to vote or to raise their hands. So there are five types: no participation, information, individual opinion, group opinion, and full PDM. Now, what we did was we did a survey. All right, and in fact, this survey was done including some nurses in Australia. Now, there are many digress I can show, but in fact, Professor Didi Patay, which I'm sure you all know, the famous hospital epidemiologist in Geneva, took the data from my study and draw a nice diagram. So I thought I would just use his diagram, which is published in the Journal of Hospital Infection 2004. Now, as the diagram shows, first, if you look at the histogram, it is a different type of participatory decision-making, the different types of PDM. Now, then if you look at the graph, as shown here, the response from the staff, their preference would be the full PDM or what we call representative PDM. That means that the staff would like to be consulted. But the histogram simply shows this is what we do or practice in a hospital. Now, let me again summarize. Often in the hospital setting, we don't ask our staff to be involved in the decision making. But then you will find from this study, when we survey the staff, if you consult them, it will really work better. They like to be consulted. Now, let me say a word on the last item on the right of this chart that is called representative full PDM. Now, what does that mean? Well, as you know, in the hospital, logistic-wise, it's not easy to get all the nurses or the doctors to vote. So this representative simply means instead of getting all to vote, we get a representative from that particular ward or unit. They come to some place or a meeting, and they get to vote on the behalf of their unit or department. Now, interestingly enough, as you can see in this graph, at least in our survey, the hospital staff find this very acceptable. They need not vote themselves, but if they have a rep going out to the management to vote for them, it is already very acceptable. In fact, if you look at this graph, it scores even higher. The representative PDM scores even higher than the full PDM. All right, so that's very interesting enough. Now, let me close on this section with slide 22. In fact, we did a quasi-experiment, a real study, implementing an IV guideline with these five different PDM. And as you can show in this data, interestingly enough, the group discussion and the full representative PDM actually has no statistical difference in actual practice. So our conclusion was that, in fact, when you get hospital staff to come and discuss the issue with you, and if you give them enough freedom to express themselves, they probably already feel that they were given a chance to participate. So therefore, in a real quasi-experiment study, the group discussion scores just as well as the full PDM. Okay, let's move on to the final thing we can learn from behavioral science is consumer's behavior. All right, now, consumer behavior is simply behavioral science studied by those in marketing. Now, one very common idea in consumer behavior is this thing called opinion leaders, and it's defined in slide 24. Now, what are opinion leaders? Well, it's very simple. We all know this word. It simply says that in any social group, there are some people in the group that exert great influence. All right? So we know that this is true in the hospital. You go to the ward, you will find that there are some nursing sisters or even ordinary registered nurse who really has an influence. So what we did was we did a study, in fact, way back, we did a study in which we have here in slide 25, group A and group B. Group B we only give lectures. In group A we give lectures, and we also get the help of some opinion leaders from the ward. And as you can see, the results in group A was clearly and drastically better than group B, suggesting that if you get the right opinion leader in the ward who is a member of their own staff to help you to conduct the education, you get better results. And slide 26, in fact, is also drawn by Professor Pite in his paper, and it's shown here again before and after. Those with opinion leader has a much better reduction in incorrect practices. Now, by the way, it's with this study and with this paper that we wrote an early paper that suggests that we should have this thing in slide 27 called the Lingner's Program. And this is what we do in my hospital now. We have this Lingner's Program in which we give 2 days training course to 2 Ling nurses in every ward. These Ling nurses are sort of screened and appointed by their ward, and there are 2 for each ward, and we give them education, and after that they receive a certificate. Now, in fact, this is shown in slide 28, whereby they have a certificate, and we also give them a badge called a Ling Nurse. Now, we found this system and program to be very effective. In fact, slide 29 shows the results of another study. Now, I will not go through all of it. It is a study comparing sharp box, and it shows pre-lingness and post-lingness. Now, just take one example, overfill sharp box. When there were no lingness, 51% were overfilled. With lingness, only 8.8%, showing a clear, distinct advantage. Now, let me just stress again that this link nurse can really be a good program for you to implement in your hospital. It takes some time. You may have to discuss with your nursing management and then to appoint two of them. What we do is this. The nurses who are willing to be link nurse will come for these 2 days of training during office hours. But that's all. They are not allowed to reduce any of their routine work just because they are link nurse. Now, in fact, these link nurses during SARS was a tremendous advantage for us. They were always the first to tell us what's going on in their different wards. And they are sort of like our friends, a link of communication network chain all over the hospital, helping us to implement infection control policy. All right, now, so let's move on. With this background, let me then propose how we can implement a guideline. Now, I will just keep slide 30 because it's just a diagram showing the various methods and going to slide 31. Now, based on what I've discussed so far, this is a format on how you can implement a guideline. As you know, we all use guidelines, and this is a 7-step process that may help you. All right, now, let's go through these steps one by one. First of all, you have a guideline. You should take this guideline. It could be from the CDC. It could be from WHO. You need to format this guideline according to your own hospital needs. All right? That means those that is not relevant to your institution, just don't use it. And you may want to add one or two more that is very special. And in step one, you may also want to add details like where do you get certain protective equipment, who to contact, to write all this in the guideline. Now, once you finish step one, you go on to step two, which is you take all the recommendations in the guideline and classify them into 4 main types. All right? Now, what are the 4 main types? Well, the 4 main types are given in slide 32. Well, the 4 main types are classify them into established practices. Now, these established practices are those practices that even though without the guideline, it's already been done. All right? Now, then, 2, 3, and 4 are the non-established practice. Now, let me give you an example of an established practice. For instance, in the WHO hand hygiene guideline, you are supposed to have hand hygiene after you touch excreta, all right, or any body secretion. It's clearly written in the WHO guideline. Now, I'm sure that even without this guideline, people are already practicing it, right? So this would be an established practice. Now, then 2, 3, 4 are the non-established practice. That means it's really not been practiced in your hospital yet. Now, 2 is not practiced yet, but it's probably going to be very easy. All right? Let me give you an example. For instance, in the WHO guideline, it is stated that you should not use hot water to wash your hands because it is bad for the skin. I think in my hospital, I'm sure in yours too, this is not going to be that difficult to implement. It's a matter of just telling them. Now, number 3 is non-practice, non-established practice because lack of resources. Now, this is a situation whereby they will probably do it, but they just don't have the resources. So, for instance, in the WHO guideline, probably one recommendation in this category is to use the alcohol hand wrap. Now, if the alcohol hand wrap is not available, you therefore cannot practice it. And finally, staff resistance. Now, this is the difficult one. These are the ones that the staff will resist. So in the WHO guideline, hand hygiene, for instance, you are recommended to only use 1 glove per patient. Now, the staff may resist it, especially in blood taking. Now, so all in all, you classify all the recommendations into the 4 basic types. Now, who does the classification? Well, we discover that when you get a senior nurse who has been working in the ward for more than 10 years or 15 years, you take the guideline and ask them to put it into these 4 groups, they can do it quite easily. In fact, we have researched this, and this is shown in the next slide, slide 33. We have found that when a senior nurse takes 5 CDC guidelines and classify them into those 4 types, they are pretty accurate. because they know the word, and they know their people. Now, so, once it is classified into the four groups, you can go on to the following steps. Now, in the classification, remember, you have a group that needs extra resources, right? So now, number three, for instance, if it's alcohol hand wrap, the next step is to get those resources. Now, then number four, you should conduct some research. It may not be very intricate or complicated. Just find out why the staff would receive. What are the difficulties? All right? So once three and four is completed, number five, obviously you measure the baseline rates. All right? And then you formulate an educational program, carry out the educational program, and then, of course, number seven is to evaluate your progress. Now, let us have a few words on number six, the educational program. Okay, now, if you look at the educational program in the next diagram, next slide, slide 35, it will give you some clues. Now, the educational program should be geared to the different types of practices. For established practice, it's just a matter of announcement. They should then go on doing it because they are supposed to be already doing it. Then for easy implementation, it's just the usual educational program. Just tell them, explain to them. That's it, they will do it. Then for the no resources, you just got to provide the resources. Now, let me again repeat here. One of the greatest frustrations for hospital staff is to have a new guideline out and no resources. What is recommended, the article or the PPE is not there in the ward. So make sure you get the resources in place before you introduce the new guideline. And finally, now let me again underline, usually the success or failure of your new guidelines is dependent on this last item. Are you able to convince your colleagues that feel on the difficult recommendations that is attached to this guideline? If you cannot do it, the guideline may fail. But if you can do it, then it will be successful. Alright? So this is the steps that you can use to implement any guidelines. Alright? And the seven steps, in fact, this is sort of published in the WHO hand hygiene guidelines. There's a whole chapter on it, and I recommend that you refer to it. Now, finally, let's go on to a few things. Number one, in the review by Kritzer and Larson in the AJIC, they say that it is not just paradigms of behavioral science. You must take the whole organizational environment into consideration. And based on this, they say that you must adopt new management paradigms, as in 37. Now, I have no time to, I therefore pick up two management paradigms, but because of the limit of time, I will just deal with one. Because probably the other one, you're already very familiar with. Now, the one that I pick up to talk first is this thing called job enrichment. Now, what is job enrichment? Job enrichment simply is a paradigm that suggests how you should redesign tasks and responsibilities to enhance motivation and satisfaction. Now, so look at slide 40. This is their paradigm. You need to understand the job characteristics. Then you need to understand the psychological state. And then you understand the and measure the outcome. So it's job characteristics, psychological state, and the outcome. And the whole thing is called the job characteristic model. Now, based on this model, they say that when you design a new task or a new workflow or a new guideline, there are five steps. And this is shown in slide 41. Number one, task identification. Number two, designing natural work units. Number three, vertical loading. Number four, establishing client relationship. And number five, open feedback channels. All right, let me just briefly go through this. So, using these five steps, we implemented a respiratory guideline in our hospital. In fact, we call it a ventilatory care guideline. This is in slide 42. Now, so what is the first step? The first step, as shown in slide 41, is task identification. So, from the guideline, we wrote down all the different tasks and classified them. So, for instance, if you look at slide 42 and slide 43, you'll find that all the tasks are classified into A, oxygen therapy, B, respiratory care, and then, that's right, just 42 and 43. All the tasks are sort of classified into oxygen therapy and respiratory care. Now, then we also, on the right side of this table, put the frequency, how often these are done. Now, after classifying that, if you look at the five steps, is the second step is designing work unit and assign responsibility. So the next thing we did was in slide 44, whereby we then say which staff is responsible for which task. So it's all written down in slide 44. Okay. Now, let me just say that the actual diagram that we used when we were doing this guideline is more complicated than this. This is simplified, but it's still true nevertheless. We write down the task and we say who is to do it. Okay, now, then the next step in the five-step scheme is vertical loading. Now, what is the vertical loading? Vertical loading is simply making sure that the responsibility is done and there is freedom and autonomy. So it's a matter of sitting down with each staff, making sure that they know their responsibility and making sure that they are trained for it. All right. Now, one example that we did is in point 2 in slide 45. We decided to call one of the nurse, one of the duties, the ventilatory equipment care nurse or the VEC nurse, so that this nurse is responsible for all the disinfection of the ventilatory care equipment. All right. So she's given this thing called VEC nurse, and she knows that she's responsible to do all these things. Now, we find that this really works, and it helps the student nurse because she knows that she has to do it, and it defines the responsibility. Now, finally, in the last step is enhancing client relationship. So to make sure we do that, we really have this, like point 2, I'm sure many of you are doing it, a named nurse thing. Patients group are grouped into cubicles, and there's one nurse in charge. The nurse knows that she's in charge of the patient, and as usual, then they understand that who they are looking after. All right, now now we come to slide 47, open feedback channels. All right, to make sure that the nurses really communicate with the patient and with one another, we did the following things. The four steps are given there. I will not go through all of them. The nurse in charge of access must daily record, have all recording daily in each shift so that we know what's going on. Now, number 2, for instance, the VEC nurse, she's in charge of disinfection. So she has to sort of write down all equipment sent to the CSSD that they are properly disinfected, all recorded, so that all these feedback channels are all clearly established. Now, but anyway, let me show you the results. If you look at the results on the prevalence survey in slide 48, now this table is quite simple if you understand it. LRTI is ventilator-related pneumonia. Now as you can see, we introduced this guideline in 95-96, and the infection rate, the prevalence rate, dropped from 4.4 in the previous year down to 2.2. And this guideline was introduced using the model which I told you about, the job characteristic model. All right. Now, so this is one management paradigm. There are many management paradigms that are in practice in the hospitals and in management companies and so on. And this is one example. Another very well known example is CQI. And you can see the slides yourself, but I have no time to go into it. But right now, one opportunity for us in infection control is to take some of these management paradigms, whole management paradigms, and try to see if we can implement them using our infection control environment to exploit their principles and to implement them and to make them work. All right, now let me close by going to slide 71. Slide 71, which actually is a very interesting study, and I want to close with this. Now, what is slide 71? It's basically an ethnographic study. Now, I'm sure you are so familiar with study on compliance and so on in the literature, but all these studies are what we call quantitative studies. Now, this final study in slide 71 is a qualitative study. In fact, it's an ethnographic study, and it was done by a PhD student, which I put here is W.L. Siegel. It's not me, it's really my brother. Now, what happened was that he comes into my hospital and spends nearly 2 years in my unit studying how infection control works. Now, slide 72 summarizes the research protocol. Basically, he says spent 12 months, in fact, a bit more, observing what's going on in my department. And then, after all the observations, he came out with slide 73, which is the nurse's workshop. Now, let me explain that a little bit. What he said is this in his PhD thesis, that the work of the nurse is divided into two big aspects. One is to care for patients, and other is the formal structural complete of treatment orders from the doctors. Now, based on these two sort of classification, the work of the nurse then has four basic building blocks, and they're all important. The building blocks are, number one, I start from the bottom, the job in its own right. That means, is the pay good? Are the facilities acceptable, like any other job? But then the second one, from the bottom, is human touch. Is it really helping my patient? This is the human touch. The third is the clinical knowledge and technique, the professional knowledge of the nurse. Now, but also very important is the one on the top. And I put that quote. Now, we have discovered, at least in Hong Kong, but I'm sure in your place too, a very important thing that crosses nurses' mind is, can I cope? Here I'm already juggling. I'm already juggling three or four items. And you give me one more. Now, if she cannot cope, she simply will not accept anymore. So these are the four basic building blocks in what we call the nurses' workshop. Now, in fact, we did a survey on this, and this is summarized in slide 76. We surveyed 1,000 of our nurses to see if this workshop is true. So slide 77, for instance, we asked, can you divide nurses' work into two areas? And 84% agrees that it's true, it's correct. Now then slide 78, we ask, which is the area that give you the most job satisfaction? And clearly it stated that it is carrying out the nursing care plan. Now, so based on these results and also from the qualitative paradigm, let us look at slide 75. Slide 75. Now, slide 75 is simply a proposal by the author. That here you are, you have the personal and the formal workshop, the nurse, and the building blocks. If you want to do infection control, since it is the personal that gives the greatest job satisfaction, we should implement infection control policies based on these personal aspects rather than on the formal or the doctor's order. In other words, whenever you introduce infection control guidelines and practices to the nurses, make sure that it comes and she understands that it is part of her nursing care plan and not just because the doctor says so. All right. Now, I will skip some of this data and go on to slide 86, which is just a redrawn of the nursing workshop, and now to slide 87. Now, this is very important. Slide 87. Now, in slide 87, this is a question we asked in the survey. When you're following infection control policies, do the following occur? Now, this question actually is designed to assess the four building blocks. Remember the four building blocks. Let's look at slide 86 again. It's job in its own right, human touch, clinical knowledge, and coping. Now, we decided not to assess job in its own right because obviously it's important, the pay and so on, right? So, therefore, we assess the other three. Now, let's look at the results in slide 87 again. Actually benefit the patient. Now, the mean score out of a 7 is 5.6. Not too bad. Now, the next two columns actually is the same result as from the mean, but now divided according to whether the nurse thinks that it is he's doing it because of the nursing care plan or whether she's doing it because of treatment order. As you can see, if the nurse believes that he or she is doing it out of nursing care plan, the score is drastically or clearly higher, 5.6 as compared to 5.3 for treatment order. Now, then number two, it increased quality of nursing care. The mean is 5.7. And again, as you can see, if the nurse believes he or she is doing it out of nursing care plan, it's 5.7 as compared to 5.4 if he or she is doing our treatment order. Now, very important, the last. It increased work and can I cope? So the last question is on coping. The mean is 3.9. Ah, very interesting. Both nursing care plan and treatment orders has the same result of 3.9. Now, how do we explain this? Well, I think it's quite clear. In other words, if your colleagues in the ward believe that he or she cannot cope, then they will never comply. No matter how ingenuine or how good the policy is, if they believe they cannot cope, they will not comply. And so, that's why in slide 88, this is the conclusion. Perhaps, they are not washing their hands because they cannot cope. Now, in fact, there are many studies showing this. Let's look at now slide 91. Now, slide 91 is a famous study by Professor D.D. Pate on hand hygiene, published in The Lancet. Now, the slide is very simple. If you take a look at the first diagram, it is just to compare compliance on the y-axis with workload on the x-axis. Now, as you can see, when the workload increases, compliance goes down, right? But when the workload decreases, the more it approaches zero in the workload, the compliance goes up. So we all know that, isn't it true? If there is not much work, we do hand hygiene. If you are busy, hand hygiene goes down. Now, the next diagram is introducing hand rub. Now, I'm sure you all know by now that the alcohol hand rub, the main reason for the alcohol hand rub is not just because it kills bacteria better. The main reason is to save time. Because to wash your hands, you really need 1 to 2 minutes. Walking to the sink, applying the soap, and washing it away takes 1 to 2 minutes. The hand hygiene takes 15, maybe 20 seconds, and maybe even 10 seconds. Now, so the hand rub saves time. In other words, the alcohol hand rub helps our colleagues in the front line to cope. Now, look at the second diagram again in slide 91. The slide 91 shows that the moment you introduce the alcohol hand rub, there is no more relationship between workload and compliance. In other words, as D.D. Pate says, you bypass the time constraint. So therefore, this again illustrates a very important principle already mentioned in the qualitative study. If you cannot help the staff to cope, if they don't believe that adding this new item for infection control somehow can still help them to cope, you can expect them not to comply. All right, now I've gone through many things and I hope that these are just the beginning for you. These just, I hope, are the catalyst, the spice to get you interested to go into the literature, to find out more in the field of social and behavioral science and in the management paradigms, and then to absorb all you can from all these various fields and to apply it in our important field of infection control. So finally, get compliance? Well, just keep doing it. As I show in this cartoon, you know, as shown here, there's this guy looking up, then there are two, then there's a group. If you look long enough, the lady who looks out the window will also look up, and then if you really do it long enough, then even the angels will comply. Now, so this is the end of my talk. Compliance is crucial. Without compliance, we cannot do infection control. So let us learn from the behavioral science and apply all we can and make sure it works. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Sito. I think we do have an awful lot to learn from these behavioral studies, and particularly interested in the qualitative study that you talked about at the end there, and applying that to practice. I will take the phone off mute for other people if they would like to ask questions of Professor Sito. Now's a good time to make contact. I've just got a very quick question. There have been studies, I heard of one at a conference a short while, well, I think it's the year before last, about the use of cell phones and getting messages about out about things like non-smoking, particularly for youngsters. Has that been looked at in relation to healthcare and education, and not, see, I'm not expecting healthcare workers to carry cell phones around, but in terms of technology and advances, is there any advantage, do you think, to looking at some of these other ways of getting messages out?
Cell phones? Well, I'm not familiar with that, but we all know that we must maximize technology to achieve compliance. In fact, the best way to compliance is if they has, can do no otherwise. So, for instance, this is the reason for the needleless system, all right? If there is no needle, you cannot get prick your hands, you see. And that is why in the States they have a policy now, in fact it's signed into law, that all new needleless systems must be used, you see. So before you even want to use human behavior, technology is important. Whatever technology can offer, then it should be okay. But having said that, we all know that there are at least 200 over patient care practices that require compliance. So no matter what technology we use, we'll never cover all of it. So at the end of the day, we must still apply whatever new behavioral science technique that is in the market. So yes, why not research on using phone for communication, but make sure you measure it properly, all right? And in measurement, it's important that you try to measure it two ways. One, of course, is you can observe, but this has the Hawthorne effect, or we call it the obtrusive way. Always in behavioral science research, add a non-obtrusive way, all right? This is very important. And if both ways shows convergence, then you are more assured that the changes you implement had worked.
Okay, thanks for that. We're certainly looking down more and more the route of computer-aided learning and access to that here. Paul, do you have any questions for Professor Peter? I think I heard your voice a moment ago.
Well, thank you. I do want to say that was perhaps one of the most exciting teleclass lectures that we've had, and I'm so grateful for it. I just noticed on slide number 93, you have a promotion there for a conference.
Oh, yes.
And do you want to describe something about that conference?
Yeah, you probably know about it. We're going to have the third International Congress for our society in July 2007. In fact, all the well-known speakers will be there, Professor Pite, for instance, and the others, WHO. In fact, the WHO, for instance, the WHO has now come up with a new guidelines to help in pandemic flu. It's called the Acute Respiratory Disease Guideline. And the concept is this. The concept is there are so many guidelines preparing us for war, and it may not come for some time, right? So why don't we write a guideline for peace? Now, what is the guideline for peace? During peacetime, people come to your hospital presenting as acute respiratory disease, right? So why don't we have a guideline for that? So the WHO has completed this guideline, and it will be presented. In fact, I think this is the first time in an international meeting this is presented. And you will be in Kuala Lumpur. You're most welcome to go. Now, I myself is not really one of the organizers. I'm just doing a favor for them. But they have this conference in Kuala Lumpur, 8th to the 11th of July. And if you... Now, I understand they have a website. Just go into it, type APSIC, and, you know, you can even sort of apply on their website. So, or ask any of your companies that is in your area, and I'm sure they have heard about this and asked to send people there. Yeah, just a little bit of advertisement for the sake of Kuala Lumpur.
Thank you very much for that, Professor Sito. I've really, really appreciated your input. This was a wonderful contribution to this series. I sincerely hope that we can persuade you perhaps to come back to us and contribute to the South Pacific Teleclass series again in the future. Thank you for joining us, and from all of us here in Christchurch, goodbye.